There is a little bit from the last class that I didn't get to because we got caught up in the six questions of the king. So, as Geshe-la said in class before, this is the book that makes aryas, you know? I mean, this was written to, designed for us to become aryas when we study it. And we have proof of that because Master Sangha wasn't an arya when he got the book, and then he studied it along with Maitreya's other four books, and then he became an arya. A little bit of the history. When Arya Sangha got to Shishida, he reached a level on the path on Jorlam called Chugyun Gitingzin, which is, remember we went over the four levels yesterday, which, do you guys remember? That's okay. Right, so he reached Chugyun Gitingzin is specifically on the point of mastery, on the third level of the second path. And it means you're damn close to seeing emptiness directly. You know, you're almost there. You're at the third level. The fourth level is seeing dependent origination directly. It happens pretty fast, you know. I mean, you go through that and, you know, half an hour later you're in the direct perception of emptiness. So you don't really get to the fourth level of Jorlam until you're almost ready. So the third level is really, really close. And in Chugyun Gitingzin, which I have a hard time saying, like a tongue twister, you gain certain abilities. And one of them, the most prominent of these, is the ability to remember perfectly every single Dharma teaching you've ever had. And people, you can kind of see there are certain people, maybe that you know, who have this ability on a lower level. I mean, they're starting to get it. They seem to never have to study, and they just suddenly spout off a quotation from something that they heard 6 months ago or something like that. Or they, Petra has it. Yeah, or they remember books really, really clearly. And that's a sign of getting up on the path of Jorlam. And I just thought this was really interesting because, you know, most of us are on that path. Most of us haven't reached the point where we've seen emptiness directly. And so it's really nice to know where you are on the path. And really nice to know that because Jorlam seems to be this really big amorphous thing that you don't get out of anytime soon, you know? And it's nice to have levels, you know? It's nice to have stages within that that you can mark your progress as you're meditating. So and that's the whole point of studying people like Arya Sangha's life, you know? We know we're getting there. We know we can do it. So Arya Sangha wasn't an Arya when he came back from Tushita. He reached that stage later in his life when he began teaching, that according to the ancient scriptures. So that's something to think about for everyone. Maybe there's a certain karma there to passing on the Dharma that leads you to a greater understanding of it yourself. And by the end of his life, he reached the third bodhisattva level. Now, in comparison, it's said that Arya Nagarjuna only reached the first bodhisattva level. And Lord Maitreya, during this point, was on the 10th bodhisattva level. So you can kind of structure your thoughts about them in that way.
My homework.
And this was in the reading, so I didn't feel guilty about not covering it yesterday because I gave you the reading. So, but I thought that we should talk about it in class anyway, just because, in case you never get to that reading, you know. it's a short period of time to go through this much information, and I know it's kind of hard to squeeze homeworks and readings and everything. So, yesterday we got sort of an outline about what the whole Uttara Tantra was about, you know, the seven diamond-like visions. And really, that's the entire book, you know, those seven diamond-like visions. And it's all centering, well, first of all, it's centering on the three jewels, you know, but in sort of a different aspect than you normally see them, right? It's centering on refuge to the three jewels. And there are two reasons to take refuge, and I'm sure someone in this illustrious group would be able to tell me what they are.
Fear and faith.
Right, you're afraid of something, and you think that the person you're going to refuge to, or that the object you're going to refuge to, is going to be able to help you. So here's an interesting question. The odd part about the Uttara Tantra is that you're taking refuge in your own future Buddhahood. Now, why take refuge in your own future Buddhahood, you know? How is that going to help you, you know? It's and that's sort of the crux, I think, of this book in particular. That's the unique aspect of it. And that's the reason why it's the basis for tantric presentations. You know, it's sort of a bridge between sutra and tantra. It is a sutra text. It's considered a sutra text, but it's leading you into a deeper kind of refuge and a deeper understanding of emptiness. Because only with that deeper understanding of emptiness could you ever understand why taking refuge in your own future enlightenment would be able to help you. You know? So this brings us back to what we were talking about before. Maitreya's five books were each designed for certain students. And this particular book was designed for the highest type of student. This means the student that the book was designed for,
say Chedu Jawe, Dulja. Chedu Jawe, Dulja.
So, this book, yeah.
You can. Letters make the meaning the highest type of student.
Dulja is disciple. Or Dulwa?
Dulwa.
Dulja, yeah. And, yeah, and it means, yeah, the one that needs to be disciplined. The one that needs to be tamed. They actually use it to, like, for reining in horses and stuff. And they use it for us, too. So, and you can understand why if you've ever tried to practice Dharma and fought with your mind at all. And Chedu Jawe is just an idiom. Meaning designed for, or, you know.
That's interesting that disciple and discipline is the same word.
Yeah, Dulwa and Dulja. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, it's nice. Um, So this is in general what disciples who study this book must be. Say Tekchen Rikchen. Tekchen Rikchen. And Huang Nun. What does Tekchen mean? Tekpa Chenpo. Yeah. Higher way, highest vehicle, you know, Mahayana path. And Rikchen. Rik means family here. And Chen is highest, you know, or highest family, which means the entering the family of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas when you take your Bodhisattva vows, that whole aspect of family. It means you have to have a higher motivation than just serving yourself, than just getting to a lower nirvana. You have to want to bring every living being up along with you. You know, you have to have the greatest capacity. So that's the first general quality. And the second quality, does anyone know what Wang means?
Power.
Power, right. And Nun means sharp. And it in this case, it refers to your intellectual capacity to understand, specifically emptiness. You have to have a high intellectual capacity to study this text. Well, these are two general qualities, and then we're going to go into three more specific characteristics of a disciple with these qualities. Also has to have three more characteristics. It's so galupa, you know, these little outlines with the levels and A and B and I, and you know, it just keeps going.
So that first one, is it realized bodhicitta in the mind, or is it just,
I think it's just aspiring. Because when you take your bodhisattva vows, it's not necessary for you to have realized bodhicitta in your mind. And they use the same phrase here, you know, you've entered into the family of the Buddhas by your intention of even wanting to take those vows. You know, even though we're nowhere near, or maybe, I don't know, I'm nowhere near having that quality for real, you know. So, lucky for us, it's not actual bodhicitta that they're talking about. Wonder how they could screen that at the door, you know. It's like, okay, you can only have actual bodhicitta to come into this room.
Like,
yeah.
Maybe honor system.
Have to be, right? Okay. So, in addition to having a Mahayana ideal and high intellectual capacity, there are three characteristics that the ideal student should have for studying this book. In Tibetan, it's gupa. Gupa? Gupa. And in Sanskrit, it's karya. Karya. Mm-hmm. And this means need. You have to have a very strong reason. You have to have a burning desire to take away all the suffering that you see in this world. And there are two ways that they say you can develop this need if you don't already have it. The first is karuna. Say karuna.
Karuna.
Karuna. Now this is a retroflex N. So when you say it, you have to curl your tongue so that the bottom of your tongue is touching the roof of your mouth. Karunna. Yeah. And Ningje in Tibetan. So what's Karunna?
Compassion.
You have to work on developing your compassion. And so this is a second way to develop that need. And we talked about it in class before. Say ashaya vishuddhi. Ashaya vishuddhi. This S is the same kind of retroflex as the na. So sha. Yeah. And in Tibetan, it's hlaksam, namdak. And we talked about that in class. Do you remember what it is? Yeah, yeah. I'm going to do it myself. You know? Forget waiting around for everyone else. It has to be done, so I'll just deal with it, you know? So will it work if you develop compassion and you develop a sense of personal responsibility? Do you think you'll reach a state where you absolutely need to stop pain in this world? Yeah. Thank you. The second characteristic that you, all of us ideal students, should have. Second one is shakyate. Shakyate. And in Tibetan, nupa. Nupa. Mm-hmm. And this means capacity or ability. Specifically, the way that you get ability or capacity is what? What do you think? How would you gain the ability to help all living beings or end the suffering in this world? Specifically for this book, it's the wisdom side. They emphasize the wisdom side. So this is how you develop your capacity. Say shunyata. 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 Jnanam. Shunyata. Jnanam. So this means understanding emptiness. There's a little dot under this H.
And a short U
shunyata. Sorry. It's a long U. Yes, thank you. Shunyata. And we discussed this in the Yoga Sutra. Shu or shva. It means to swell, like a bubble swells. And it came into English like cave, spa, like it kind of switched, cave, spa. And so you see how the root even means something with nothing inside it, you know? It's but it's really interesting, all the Sanskrit words. Every single thing it ever comes from Sanskrit all comes from a verbal root. So everything stems from something that did something, you know, it's from an action. And then only afterwards do you get the nouns, you know? Yeah, that's the root for shunyata, or shunya. Right, all the roots of Sanskrit.
And in Tibetan, that would be Tongpanyi.
Tongpanyi Tokpa. Or you can abbreviate it, Tongyi. Ritokspa. Tongyi Tokpa. What happens if you leave the sa out of Tokpa? Do you know?
Namtok. Conceptualization.
Yeah, it means to think something is something, which, and this one means to realize. So they're almost opposites. It means, that one means almost a, it's almost implying an invalid, an incorrect perception. You think something is this way, but, you know, there's a but implied there, you know? So you have to be careful not to leave your suffix off the tokpa. So there's one more characteristic.
Say propti.
Propti.
Toparja.
Toparja. This T is a second column ta, so it has a little bit of a in it. Toparja, as opposed to to. Or to, you know, this the first or the third column. So this means I must achieve. So what's the difference between the first characteristic and the third characteristic?
One's recognition of the need, the other is the determination.
Good. It's almost like you you reach a decision at this point. Right. Now, Gyaltsub J, he adds a fourth characteristic because he's just like this. And it's something that we already discussed. And he doesn't do it in Sanskrit because he was writing in Tibetan. So, say Wang Dul Min. Wang we had before? Yeah. And it means the same as it did before. And dul is just the opposite of nun.
Yes.
Of the one we had, wang nun before, which meant sharp intellectual capacity. This is the opposite. Yeah, it's dull. Can you see?
I'm sorry.
And min means not. So Gyaltsub J thinks it's very important to repeat. Like, even after we said, oh, you have to have sharp capacity, he comes along and repeats, and no dull capacity, you know? I mean, it's, it makes you wonder who was trying to study this in his time, you know? By the way, you know? I just thought that was really funny that he did that. And this is because the not having dull capacity is primarily because of what we talked about before. Because people who don't have a sharp intellectual understanding of these things, they won't be able to grasp the idea of taking refuge in their own future Buddhahood. You know, they want to take refuge in something outside them that they can grasp onto self-existently. And that's okay for some kinds of refuge, but it wouldn't work here. So the whole point of understanding emptiness, really, is to be able to change your reality and change yourself, to be able to become the god of your world, you know? So then the text goes on to discuss retina. What's retina?
Jewel.
How did the Tibetans translate that? Do you know? Khonchok, right. What does Khonchok mean literally? Do you know? Chok means supreme, right. Kun literally means rare. So they didn't translate it as jewel. they translate it as rare supreme. Of course, it means jewel to them, but I mean, when they came along to this word, why did they do that, you know? It's because of what's in this book. It's because of what's in the Uttara Tantra. Because when the root text, the Sanskrit root text, comes along and describes Ratna, they give six different reasons why Ratna is both rare and supreme. So the whole evolution of this word in Tibetan comes from this text coming from India to Tibet and someone translating it for the first time, you know, putting down, writing down the Tibetan word for the first time, you know? It's sort of interesting. They have another word for jewel, but they didn't choose, you know, and now this one is actually more prevalent in a lot of cases than their original one. The Tibetans didn't have a written language before they started importing those Sanskrit texts. The only reason they actually developed a written language was because they wanted to preserve the knowledge they were getting from India. So, you know, that's why you can understand the Sanskrit by studying the Tibetan. There's the Sanskrit lineage has sort of been lost. You know, it's not like there are a lot of people teaching Tibetan Buddhism or Buddhism in general through the Sanskrit, you know. And it's very difficult to understand Sanskrit from the grasp that we have on it in this day and age. But you go back and you look at the Tibetan, because it had such a close-tied connection with the original Sanskrit, because it actually evolved through the Sanskrit, we can go back. You know, we have such a perfect lineage coming from the Tibetan that we can actually take the Tibetan and then go back to understand the original root text in Sanskrit better, you know? So you have to learn both. Well, depending on how much free time you have. No, this was... yeah, that's... They didn't say anything about that. Maybe a different book. I don't know. Inji Lotsawa. So here are the six reasons that the Uttara Tantra lists that the three jewels are rare and supreme. The first four will be actually describing the rare part, and then the second two describe the supreme part. You guys want to try without the transliteration? Do you guys know the Devanagari alphabet? Ut. Pada. Good. Do. Do go up here before you go down there. Dur. La. Ba. Good. Utpada Durlava. I'll write it. Anyone want to do the Tibetan?
Jungwa
Kun. Jungwa Kun. And this means difficult to come across. How rare is it to find Dharma? Do you know?
The golden yolk floating on the ocean.
Right,
it's blind turtle that comes up every 100 years and randomly puts its head in the ocean.
Yep.
It's
as rare as a blind turtle who comes up once every 100 years and puts his head through the inner tube floating on an ocean randomly, you know? I mean, we're extremely, extremely lucky to be in a place in our minds where we could even grasp this stuff, where we'd even want to listen. you know? I mean, not even counting all the other beings in the universe. I went home after retreat and I tried to talk to people about my 3-year retreat and nobody even wanted to hear what happened. I mean, I'm like, Mom, I just went to a 3-year retreat. She's like, what's for lunch? And I'm like, ah, you know, I was just like, it was just so astounding. It was so disturbing. And we're, you know, we're lucky enough to be surrounded by Dharma people a lot, you know, I mean, most of us live with like-minded people, but forget it. There are so many people out there that they don't even care. They don't even want to, they can't hear, you know? They don't have the capacity right now to hear it. You know, you could speak till you were blue in the face and nothing would penetrate. And yeah, that's something to think about, you know? How do we keep ourselves in a mind state where we're receptive to this, you know? How do we make sure that we don't suddenly become like what's for lunch, you know? You know? Probably by thinking about this. Yeah. So easy when things are going well to even Dharma people, you know, even for Dharma people, it's so easy for us to forget what we're really doing. You know, we kind of have these posh lives, you know, because we're in Dharma, we have nice karma ripening for us. So we don't have as much pain as the normal person on the street. So we tend to forget sometimes, we tend to become complacent about our goals. You know, we don't push ourselves to understand those questions that should be gnawing at us all the time, because we haven't reached the state of the third path yet, you know, and we have to push ourselves to get to, you know, peak and mastery, and, you know, we have to get there. But instead we, you know, we do the easier things, you know. For us it's like the matter of prioritization, right? You know, I study the easier text because the hard text gives me a headache, you know. Or, you know, I don't push myself quite so hard in meditation. I do that same Tonglen meditation I've been doing for a year instead of trying to take something that I don't understand out of the Uttara Tantra and meditate on that, you know, for 6 months. So I think that's one of the reasons that they list these qualities, is so that we can get, ourselves, we can get an incentive to kind of boost up our practice. Because this book, it wasn't written for my mom, you know. it was written for people like us, people who are already practicing, people who are already on the path, and they don't really have a question about coming off of it. They're just, so why did they put it in here? They put it in there to get us going, you know, to give us a kickstart on something that we got real lazy on. So here's the second. So say Nirmala.
Nirmala.
Dreame. Dreame. So what does that mean? Everybody knows, stainless or immaculate. You can tell Dreame she's like the Virgin Mary or something, you know?
She likes to go by Dreame.
Oh, that's really funny.
That's like a little
Then she's the other Mary. Either one. So this is immaculate. And The three jewels are immaculate in the sense of being free of specifically two imperfections. And the first one is not being able to protect you at all. And the second one is being able to protect you only sometimes. like when you go to the doctor, you know? And sometimes they give you something and you get better. And sometimes they give you something and it's the same, you know? I mean, that's not an immaculate source of protection, you know? That's something that fails you. Ultimately, it will always fail you, you know? And these are the only things that don't. So they're immaculate. What are we talking about before we get lost here on all these qualities? Which three jewels are we talking about? Right, right. So what is the Buddha jewel? She said Buddha jewel, Dharma jewel, Sangha jewel. What's a Buddha jewel? I mean, what did we talk about? Yeah, yesterday. Yeah. So we're taking refuge in our own future Buddhahood, which is immaculate, you know, and our perception of emptiness, or emptiness itself, you know.
Okay, so and emptiness. Have you seen the Dharma Buddha? Emptiness.
When you see emptiness for the first time, you see the emptiness of yourself. And you experience, during the time that you see emptiness, you experience the Dharmakaya of the Buddha. Sorry, this is slightly... I always forget my long A's and my short A's. That's why I have to use the computer. Okay, go for it. Right. Actually, if it's not a long A, it's pra-pa-vat-vat. Right, good. Because we normally speak with long A's, it's very hard for us at the beginning to get used to pronouncing that as it's like the yeah or like that upside down E thing that we have in the dictionary, like that sound. It's actually that sound, that that short A. Tibetan, do you know? Tunden. It's got a it's got a pre-nasal. And tu, or prabha, it means mystic power. Like magic power, really. And den, or vat, means having or possessing. Or so how do the three jewels have mystic power?
If you realize them, you can create whatever you want.
That's good. That's true. They compare them, at this point they compare them to a chintamani, or a wish-giving jewel, which, if you don't know, gives you whatever you want. You know, it's like Aladdin's lamp. You just rub it and make a wish, and it gives you whatever you want. And you guys want the Sanskrit for Chintamani? It's kind of fun. Mani is another word for jewel, right? So we've got...
just the same as Chintamani charm?
Yeah, yeah. Probably Norbu, you know. They would probably do Ratna with coin choke and Mani for Norbu. I'm not sure though. I can look it up. I'll tell you for sure tomorrow. I have a great Sanskrit Tibetan dictionary that we just input. So, no, then you get the real correlations between the what the Tibetans actually translated for that particular Sanskrit word, you know. So I could guess for you now, but I'll make sure for you tomorrow. So the wish-giving jewel, there's sort of a problem with it. In that you can't really even imagine the highest thing right now in order to wish for it. So what this one is referring to is sort of more worldly benefits, specifically getting the six kinds of clairvoyance. The six kinds of clairvoyance which people not even practicing the Buddhist path, but other people who just meditate very intensely can also get on other paths like Hindu paths. And the six kinds of clairvoyance correspond to the six senses. So you would be able to see great distances. You would be able to, you know, hear like the toilet flushing in Diamond Mountain on Bowie, you know, like you'd be able to, you know, very important things like that, you know. So, no, it's really interesting. Why would we want that? You know, isn't that kind of a distraction? You know, they always say, even especially in the yoga text, they say it's really dangerous to get these kind of magical powers because you can lose your goal. I mean, we think we have it nice now. What if you start getting magical powers? Forget practice. You know, you just go and play with them, right? So it's really dangerous. You know, you wouldn't have that impetus of renunciation anymore because you'd be living the high life, you know. It even says, I think we talked about it in the Yoga Sutra, Geshe-la's teaching, and the last quiet retreat teaching, you know. It goes through all the different kinds of clairvoyance, you know, like the pratibha, which means it's another word for power. And it says you can ruin your practice unless you're doing it for other, you know, unless you use it to help others. And the specific type of clairvoyance that you can use to help others in this case is the ability to read your students' minds. Because then you know where they are, you know what they're thinking, and you know what level they are, and you can tell them exactly what they need to know. And you can help them much, much better that way. And then, of course, eventually, when you reach full enlightenment, you can of course use this power to emanate to people directly. You know, I mean, if you take it to its full extreme, you would have the ultimate magic power, right?
So immaculate and possessing magical power are in the rare category, just because not many people have them in this world.
Yeah. And there's one more rare one, which is this one. We had this one yesterday. Yeah? Loka. Yeah. So it's Loka Alamkara. Alamkara. You guys know the Tibetan too well to test you on it. Loka Alamkara. Lokalamkara, or Jiktenkien. Jiktenkien. And this means ornament of the world. Alamkara or Kien we had yesterday in what? Right, Wintokien. Avisamaya Alamkara. So this is just a represent, like in Tibet when they put a jewel on the very, very top of their banner, like the highest points, you know, and they raise it up to the very top. And this is just symbolizing the highest thing that you could ever wish for, the highest thing you could ever attain. And these are all rare primarily in the sense of you know, being the absolutely the only refuges that that won't let you down, you know, that so now we're going to on to the supreme as part of this. You want to try? I give you a hint. That's a ra in there. Ra. In the middle of the ga. Right. Agrata. Or chokni. Say agrata. Chokni. And this means infinitely supreme. It just, well, you know, you have koin chok and then chokni, you know, chokni. So they don't, yeah, the essence of supreme, the supreme itself. And in this sense, they mean compared to fake jewels, which we discussed before. It's the difference between a cubic zirconium and a diamond, you know. I'm kind of going to cruise through the last two.
Nirvikara.
Mm-hmm. Nirvikara. Say, Nirvikara. Nirvikara. Or Gyurme. Gyurme. You know this da, when it's when there's a da, you sort of cut off the vowel so it's a little bit shorter, like me. And then when there's a sa at the end, you lengthen it a little bit so it's me, you know. And then when it's just me by itself, it's just normal. So a little bit more subtle pronunciation. Oops. So this means unwavering. Unmoving. What's another word in Sanskrit for unmoving? It's the name of one of the five Buddhas. Do you know? Akshobhya, right. So this one, there's two meanings of this. One, it means, it doesn't, the three jewels don't depend on any kind of outside conditions, like how you treat them. They're still going to be there for you. They're unwavering, you know. You can always go to them and they'll always be there. And Gyaltsub Jay says they are unwavering in another sense, in the sense that they are unchanging, in terms of emptiness itself, right? Going for refuge in. I know, emptiness. Are they all unchanging? Are they all emptiness itself? What are we talking about here? We're talking about, what's the Buddha jewel? Right, so there's an increasing level of subtlety that Gyaltsub Jay is pushing us to when he says they're all unchanging. you know? Because what we discussed yesterday was the future Buddha that we would become, right? But that's not an unchanging thing. Gelsub J goes further, and actually the Uttara Tantra goes further in the Three Jewels and describes... like the emptiness of the mind of the person that you will become, you know, or the emptiness that you see at the point when you see emptiness directly. What about Sangha Jewel? The emptiness in the mind of an Arya as they are perceiving emptiness directly, or the cessations. Are cessations a negative thing? What three things do you give up when you see emptiness directly?
Your intellectual belief
in self-existence, right? Intellect
doubt.
And doubt. The third one is the belief that you can hurt yourself, and that would be a spiritual path. It's not as important as the first two, unless you live in India. You know, you get those people like standing on one leg for 20 years and stuff.
Throwing themselves on tridents.
Right, exactly. That's actually, a lot of the references are that. You know, there are certain ancient Indian schools that believed that if you threw yourself down on a trident and landed with the trident in a certain point on your body, you know, piercing your, you know... the three points, that you would attain nirvana automatically, you know. And getting rid of that view is one of those three things you see when you see emptiness directly. So are those negative things? The lack of doubt in the mind of a person who sees emptiness directly, yeah. So you can also include cessations in the Sangha Jewel. If you're talking... Everyone... is echoing each other in this room. I heard Chukula saying the same thing I'm saying like 2 minutes later.
Yeah, if there's any insects, you get a good insect.
No, it's great. You guys all know that you're not missing anything in the other groups. You know, we're all saying the same thing. Well, pretty much, I guess. So this is a description of the two kinds of refuge that are covered in the Uttara Tantra, which we talked about before, is the reason this book is so unique. The normal refuge is called Gyui Kyabdro. Say Gyui Kyabdro. And that's taking refuge in an already enlightened being. And it's called causal refuge. Taking refuge in the cause that will bring you to Buddhahood. Then there's Drebui Kyabdro. Say Drebui Kyabdro. Drebui Kyabdro. Oh, yes. Sorry. There. And that's result refuge. You're taking refuge in the Buddha that you will become. In the enlightened being you'll become. And in the Uttara Tantra, they make a reference to a sutra by Lord Buddha where he's speaking to householders. And he says, refuge is when you see a holy being and you say, I want to be like you. You know? And that covers both. Because you're taking refuge in that person as a holy being, and at the same time you're taking refuge in eventually becoming exactly like that being. And I like that because a lot of people don't they say blah 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 blah, and they don't really know what they're thinking during that, or maybe they're the thoughts that they think they should be thinking are pretty alien. You know, I go for refuge to blah 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 blah, and they don't conjure up an image really clearly of what that means for them. But this is something that we can all relate to. This is something that we've all done, you know, since we were tiny. You know, every little kid has looked up at their, you know, their favorite blah 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 star and said, I want to be like that, you know. And that's something we really know how to do. We can really grasp, you know. We look at the llamas and we say, wow, you're so cool. I really want to be like you. How do I get there? You know. So I thought that was a really amazing part, you know, amazing thing to include in this book. You know, how to really feel, you know, inside what refuge is. You know, it's not... you don't have to do some special prayer, you know. You just have to have that desire in your mind, you know. Wow, you're so cool, you know. I want to be just like you. You know. So now we're supposed to get into the specifics of... the seven diamond-like visions. So, in the last few minutes, we're going to cover the Buddha jewel. What's that one?
Sangye
Koinchuk. Or
Buddha Ratna.
Buddha Ratna, right. Ratna. You know, if you ever wanted to learn the Devanagari script, there was this job that Geshe-la had to type in a book in Sanskrit, but he wanted people to type it in. It was in Devanagari script, and he wanted them to type it in the transliteration, you know? And I swear to God, it took people, like, within about 3 hours, they were already starting to pronounce the Devanagari script because they had to find a key for each word, you know? And if anyone ever wanted a job, we have plenty of Devanagari script. Oh, I'm sure we do. We always have more texts. Yeah. And it really was an amazing sight. Two people did it in one day, you know, with varying capacities, varying degrees of language study. No. They only did, believe me, they only did two verses. I mean, it's a really time-consuming at first because you have to find, I mean, you have to sit there and look at the key and, like, find each letter. But that doesn't matter. The point is that you'll ingrain the script in your mind and... And then eventually you'll just be able to type it like a normal text. And we're going to talk about the Buddha jewel, okay?
Me, the Buddha.
Me, the Buddha. We're going to discuss the qualities of the Buddha jewel, which... is the first like diamond-like vision, which means me, the Buddha. It's our future that we're talking about. So just so you don't forget, I'll just write it at the top. When you divide the Buddha into two bodies, which ones are they?
Form and truth.
Right. Or, yeah, like, you can call it the Dharma body and the form body, right? Or Dharmakaya and Rupakaya. Say Dharmakaya. Dharmakaya. Rupakaya. Rupakaya.
Rupakaya.
Dharma is a really interesting word. It comes from a root, dhar, meaning to hold. And the words truth and tree come from that, because they both hold fast. called. So Kendall's description of this body as the truth body is a good one, right? I'm gonna erase Sanskrit just because we need the room, but we'll leave these because we're gonna make a little chart. Under the Dharma body, they divide it into two. What's the Dharma body normally divided into? Jnana Dharma. Jnana. Right. So what's the Jnana Dharmakaya is the wisdom. And this one is the unchanging one. It's the so you can divide this one into the changing aspect and the unchanging aspect, you know? And another word that they give for this is purity. And they divided that into two also. Natural purity and achieved purity. Oh, there you go.
It's wisdom is changing in essence.
Yeah, right. So, this purity in the Buddha is what your Buddha nature develops into. Good question. How can it be achieved, right? I'll get to that in a second.
Purity is what your Buddha's energy first.
The purity is what your Buddha nature develops into when you become a Buddha. Because if you guys heard Michael Brannon's definition of Buddha nature earlier, it's mixed up with something impure. So Buddhas don't have Buddha nature. Buddha nature has to develop into something else by the time you reach Buddhahood because it's pure, right? It's purity. Well, it's a one definition of it. We're going to get to a class in Buddha nature, but one definition of it is like an undefiled seed in the mind of a person who is still mixed up in impurities. So it's pure. And that's where that whole idea of you having to uncover it comes from, you know? There are two kinds of Buddha nature which end up corresponding to this natural purity and this achieved purity. One is this. The other one is... Okay. We have just got more space here. Say, Rangshin Nirik. Gyengyurgirik. So, Rangshin Nirik is the Buddha nature that is inherent within you from since all time, since time with no beginning.
The natural one.
Right. Well, that's what it becomes when you reach Buddhahood. It isn't natural purity because you can't have Buddha nature when you become a Buddha. It has to change into something else. It's kind of like you can't do karma after you become a Buddha. You do the two collections. I mean, I think of it in the same terms. And then Gyengyurgirik is developable Buddha nature. And we're going to talk about Buddha nature in a following class, but I think it's important to correspond them to what we're talking about here.
comes to achieved purity.
Right. I know, unchanging. We still haven't gotten to that yet, right? It's actually a little bit ambiguous, you know, at this point. Because this is supposed to be unchanging, but how can you have an achievable thing or an achieved thing if this side is unchanging, right? Yeah.
Just checking.
So these three are said to accomplish your own goals. And this one is said to accomplish the goals of others. And usually we divide Dharma body and form body into that. Because other people can't see normally. This body, you have to emanate somebody that they can see. So,
why is that associated with emotions?
Oh, we're gonna get to that. So, form body and dharma body are normal divisions, but then these start to become a little bit different than what is usually talked about. For example, in the wisdom category, the achieved purity category, they put, let me do it this way. Okay. You've got all these numbers. I'm going to correspond things to these numbers because I have to have more space, but you guys just keep moving down your page here. One is natural purity.
It's your turn. Yeah, it's your
turn. This is another letter for ah. There's two ways to write ah, and this is an older version of how to write ah. So I thought I would throw it in. So
keep us on our toes.
Well, you should know bull.
So that's ah, and that's another ah, or is that the sa?
Sa.
Okay, ah, san.
What if you. Yeah, sis.
Skirt.
Skirt. Skirta. This? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Asan skirta.
Not Sanskrit?
Yes.
And we're talking about
natural purity.
Wow. That's a leap.
A sanskrta means unproduced. Because sanskrta literally means like a collection of things that were, you know, produced together, you know, like a produced language, right? And this R, which so many people who pronounce Sanskrit things, which is why Sanskrit got pronounced that way in the first place, this is a vowel that actually is IR, not RI. So actually Sanskrit should be Sanskirt, like skirt. But because us Westerners pronounced it so poorly, it got stuck Sanskrit. And that's what happens to a lot of words. Like in the yoga tradition, when people say Krishna, it's actually Krishna. Yeah. IR. So, that's just a side note. So, natural purity is unproduced because it has always been there. It's that seed in the mind that becomes the natural purity. And this is something that we'll discuss further. I think he's going to do the next class on, not this next class, but the class after that. On what it means to have a seed in the mind that is unproduced and unchanging. You know, can it be a positive seed in the mind if it's unchanging? You know, and how does it go from Buddha nature to natural purity without changing? These are all the fun questions that this text brings up in the mind. And I, personally, I just like to throw them out so you can think about them for a couple of days. Because we had months to think about them, you know. So I'm sort of throwing out things that are going to come in classes later so that you can have the opportunity, like we did, to sit and mull it over for a while before we get the scoop, you know. You know, because it's really nice. Because this is really unusual, according to all the other Buddhist texts I've studied. You know, this is sort of a rare presentation. Let's go to number two. And Buddha nature, you know, it's not that popular in Galupa texts or Galupa schools, you know. So to find a Galupa commentary on it, like Gyaltsebje, obviously Master Galupa, it's a great opportunity, and it's a great opportunity to do what His Holiness is always suggesting and try and find the commonalities between the different you know, existing, like, schools of Buddhism nowadays. So, okay. Your turn.
Annabhoga.
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 Yeah. Oh, God. Say, Annabhoga.
Annabhoga.
And, Hlungi Drupa. Hlungi Drupa. Hlun. Hlun. Okay. This means spontaneous. And this is connected to the ability to send emanations without any conceptual thought. Or just, yeah, no conceptual thought. Hlungi Drupa.
And this is related still to natural?
No, this is achieved purity. It corresponds to what we put number two, right? But I didn't... Exactly. That's a big question. You know, that was my big question when I first heard this. Why is this in the side for yourself and not in the side that has to do with others, right? Because it's not talking about the action of sending out bodies. It's talking about the mind, which is spontaneous. The spontaneity itself of the mind. Because...
omniscience is sending out bodies.
Right, I know. But we'll get to the omniscience part, hopefully. Okay, I gotta rush. It's like 2:00. So this is in contrast to, you know, every single motion is based on a self-existent desire. It's like a desire for a self-existent object. Every single thing we do or think or say, it's driven by this this ignorant desire, like either to get something we like or get away from something we don't like, right? And it's that desire itself that disappears here. It's that impetus itself, that ignorant seed. The last seed to go away. You know, this is like the very, very subtlest seed for self-existence that goes when you reach Buddhahood. And I just wanted to throw something else at you guys to think about. We talked about the idea of cause and effect. And what if you never did anything except for actual cause-effect relationships? You know, like giving away something produces wealth, right? So what if you never went and got a job? Like, what if the only thing you did was giving? You know, like that kind of thing. Like, what if you never got in a car and went to Tucson? What if you stayed at Diamond Mountain and just sat in your room and meditated? You know, would you still get food? You know? Yeah, but I mean, like, you know, it's interesting, you know, getting on a more, like, a subtler and subtler cause-effect relationship. We do tons and tons of things every single day that have nothing to do with what we profess to be actual cause-effect relationships, you know, like...
I mean, like, if you didn't eat, would you not starve today?
Right, right.
Doesn't it depend in part on the ripening, the times of ripening in this life and next life, and the future life? Have your karma?
You do.
You're engaging in this moment. You know what I mean?
In the gap.
Well, you do have to live with the karma that you have. I mean, that's a given. You know, you can't get upset because you don't have the karma for 31 flavors ice cream, you know, for dessert, you know. I mean, like, you just don't have the karma for it. So it's like, even if you went to the store, you probably wouldn't get any, you know. Like, I mean, but then there's like a subtler level of like, I was sitting in retreat and I would get a headache and I would look at these little baby aspirins, because that's the only thing that we really took was baby aspirins. And it was like a placebo effect, you know, like I knew that the baby aspirin wasn't really causing me to get rid of my headache, that it had to be another cause, but I still took the baby aspirin, you know. And why do I do that? You know, like, why live, like, and how many actions a day are we doing that's that baby aspirin thing? It's most of them, you know. It's primarily the baby aspirin that we're living for right now. And it's like, how do we get to a greater degree of flungi drupa, you know, like where we're living for, or we have done so much in terms of the actual cause and effect. We have planted so many seeds that way that we can just sit back, you know, and actually people will feed you, you know. They will come to your yurt and drop off boxes of gourmet food every single day, you know. And
isn't that like where three countless great eons comes in?
Yeah.
I mean, the long way.
No, I mean, but I'm just talking in our day-to-day life, you know, like paying attention to how much is not lungi drupa and how much we kind of self-existently try and act. And that's what they're talking about, is not doing that. That's what they're talking about, is that getting rid of that seed. Getting rid of that seed that says, I have to go across the street to a deli in order to, you know, get this certain, you know, it's... And it's so far beyond what we normally live. I'm not suggesting to, you know, sit in your house and wait for the food to come. You know, I'm not suggesting that we totally, but I'm just suggesting that it's interesting to think about. You know, it's interesting to think about what they're not doing, that we're always doing. I got to cover the next two in the next class, because otherwise you won't get a break. Or I could do it really quick. You guys vote.
Do it quick in the chair. You can do it quick and review it.
Okay, I'll do it quick. So, number three is the wisdom. And it's in Sanskrit, it's aparaprachyayodita. And I'll write it for you later. But it means cannot be perceived through another. And there's two meanings for that. One is, you can't, they're talking about the direct perception of emptiness, right? They're talking about wisdom that you perceive directly. And so one meaning of can't be perceived through another is you can't understand it by reading somebody else's words about it or by another person speaking it to you. Another person can't tell you about it. You have to do it. You have to perceive it directly yourself. And that's what it always says about emptiness, right? It's jidumepa in Tibetan. There's a very, very common phrase. It says jidumepa. It's not inexpressible. It means inexpressible. Emptiness is inexpressible. And that's what they mean, is that you can't get an understanding, a clear understanding of the direct perception of emptiness. Of course you can explain emptiness, but the direct perception of emptiness, no way, you know? Because it's, why is that? I'll just tell you. Because words are conceptual thought, right? And the direct perception of emptiness is a totally different thing. And you can't get to that totally different thing through a conceptual medium. But the other meaning of this, so that leads to the other meaning of this, which means it cannot be perceived through another meaning conceptual thought, meaning your own conceptual thought. The second meaning of cannot be perceived through another means it can't be perceived through conceptual thought, through a metaphor, a reference, because every conceptual thought is basically metaphorical. It's a representation of something rather than the thing itself. Okay, and number four is very, is contrasted to number three. Number three is, number four means understanding the total amount of everything. And number three is understanding the way things are. And specifically it says that number four is understanding everything about the first three, about the two forms of purity and about the wisdom. So that's the omniscience that they're talking about in this reference, which is a huge difference to the normal description of form body. And it makes you question why did they divide it into those two bodies? Why did they put that one on the right side? Why did they put Lingi Drupa on the left side, you know? And that's something that we don't have time to mull over right now, so you guys go think about it. And well, you gotta have a break, you know. Okay, so that's the last thing we'll cruise through, and then we can review it tomorrow. I know we didn't do any prayers before class, but why don't we just quietly dedicate whatever we've been discussing and whatever knowledge seeds have come into our minds from discussing this holy book, which will lead us to see emptiness directly.